From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I still believe to this day he is not the killer. He is not the one who killed Mr. Lambert.
8 days to execution. As prisoner Gary Graham confronts his date to die, outcry mounts over George Bush's death row. We'll talk to Gary Graham's lawyers and a Chicago Tribune reporter who just reviewed all of Bush's executions, including one in which a forensic scientist was temporarily released from a psychiatric ward to provide incriminating testimony. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Lockheed Martin Corporation has agreed to pay $13 million to the government to settle a case involving the sale of satellite technology to China in 1994. Company and Clinton administration officials told the New York Times today the company was charged with violating arms export laws. The settlement, which officials said is likely to be announced today by the State Department, the largest civil penalty ever assessed under the Arms Export Control Act, the primary law regulating sales of American technology. The Chilean military has agreed to search for the remains of 1,200 dissidents who disappeared during the dictatorship of General Augusto Pinochet from 1973 to 1990. It's doubtful that the accord between the military and moderate human rights lawyers will result in new prosecutions of human rights offenders, but it's the first time that the military has acknowledged responsibility for the disappearances of several thousand people. A senior UN official said today that international economic sanctions are depriving Iraq's schools and forcing children to work instead of education. Anupama Rao Singh, country director for the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, said Iraq, where petrodollar wealth once provided universal primary education, lacked even the basics for teaching. She said children are leaving school in droves to earn money for their families that were suffering under economic sanctions imposed after Iraq's 1990 invasion of Kuwait. A Senate committee goes behind closed doors today to discuss a bill making it a felony to leak classified information to reporters. The Washington Post says the Senate Intelligence Committee has endorsed the legislation, which calls for prison sentences of up to 3 years. The Post says Attorney General Janet Reno will oppose the bill at today's hearing. Reno and First Amendment groups have said criminal prosecutions aren't necessarily the best way to stop leaks. New York City police are accused of being slow to respond when at least 16 women were attacked in Central Park over the weekend by gangs of young men who pulled their clothes off and groped them. Police are investigating the complaints, and New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani says if the allegations are true, the officers will be severely disciplined. The mayor has offered a $10,000 reward for information leading to the arrest and conviction of any of the attackers. Men sprayed water on women, tore at their clothes, fondled them, and in some cases robbed them. Perhaps as many as 20 to 40 men took part. Two men have been arrested. Amnesty International says 1999 was a year of repression, poverty, or war for a majority of the world's population. In its annual report, the organization says it documented human rights violations in at least 144 countries last year. The report says human suffering wasn't confined to trouble spots such as Sierra Leone or Kosovo. The United States was criticized for 98 executions and allegations of police brutality or cruel treatment of prisoners. The leaders of North and South Korea reported significant progress during their historic summit, pledging to work toward reuniting thousands of families separated by the Korean War, provide investment for the North's failing economy, and eventually reunify the peninsula. However, they released no details on those and other issues, including the presence of 37,000 U.S. troops in South Korea, which the North wants removed, and the North's nuclear and missile programs. Reunification itself is an enormous task that some observers say could take decades. The announcement came during more than 3 hours of discussions by South Korean President Kim Dae-jung and North Korean leader Kim Jong-il at a government guest house in Pyongyang, the North Korean capital. The Los Alamos National Laboratory suspended 6 administrative employees yesterday as government officials acknowledged that the FBI is conducting a criminal investigation into the disappearance of 2 computer hard drives containing nuclear secrets. The 6 managers were placed on paid leave for failing to report immediately last month that the hard drives were missing from a vault at the laboratory, which has been dogged by espionage allegations over the past 2 years. Lots of legal maneuvering in the Microsoft case. Government attorneys have filed their expediting request with U.S. District Judge Thomas Penfield Jackson. The judge is expected to approve sending the case straight to the U.S. Supreme Court instead of an appeals court, as Microsoft wants. And that's some of the news at this hour. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, here with Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and to all of our listeners. And they've announced the MacArthur Awards for this year, and there are a couple of people that we know well on the list, aren't there, Amy?
That's right. Well, you know Cecilia Munoz, who works with the National Council of La Raza.
Yes, she's the legislative director there at the Council of La Raza, and really one of the most brilliant people, certainly one of the most brilliant Latinos when it comes to legislation in Washington and what are the bills that most affect both Latinos and working people in general. And it's great to see that somebody's recognized her talent.
The MacArthur Awards give $500,000, $500,000, to 25 people this year. Also from Washington, Deborah Willis, who is the curator of exhibitions at the Center for African American History and Culture and the Anacostia Museum at the Smithsonian Institution. Author Patricia Williams, who's a professor at Columbia University Law School. Peter Hayes, who is executive director of the Nautilus Institute for Security and Sustainable Development, known for his work in North Korea. And also, and this shows the power of community radio, David Isay. He is an independent radio producer many people may know from National Public Radio, but he got his start here at Pacifica Station WBAI. I remember it well, getting frequent calls from David over a period of a few weeks saying, why don't you cover the Museum for Drug Paraphernalia that is being set up by 2 former addicts on the Lower East Side. He continually called into the newsroom. We were, as usual, under-resourced and under siege. And finally, after his 10th call, I said, whoever you are, why don't you cover it? Well, the next day he brought in a reel of tape. It was about 6 minutes. He went and he interviewed the husband and wife who wanted to set up this museum. And it was quite incredible. And his program, his piece aired on the WBAI News that night. And David has gone on to do remarkable pieces on many different issues. And it's really a wonderful testament to the access that people in the community have to community radio. And we thank the whole community radio network for that. And congratulations to David. Well, today, Juan, we're moving on to a very critical issue. We're moving on to the death penalty that has been gaining attention around the country as the abolitionist movement, the movement to abolish the death penalty, grows by leaps and bounds and reaches sectors of society many thought not possible, with governors like conservative Republican George Ryan of Illinois putting a moratorium on the death penalty in his state because more than a dozen people have been freed from death row when it was proved that they were innocent of the crimes charged. Is the death penalty collapsing under the weight of its own mistakes? That's the conclusion report released this week. The study is called Broken System, Error Rates, and Capital Cases. It examined every capital conviction and appeal between 1973 and 95, nearly 5,500 decisions. The report found that nearly 70% of death sentences brought before an appeals court were overturned. The common reasons for overturning the cases were incompetent defense lawyers, prosecutorial misconduct, usually the suppression of evidence, and faulty instructions to jurors. We're joined right now by the author of the study. James Liebman is professor of law at Columbia Law School. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
Well, can you lay out this really vast and unprecedented report that you've done?
Well, what we tried to do was just find out what the courts themselves think about the death sentences that our capital punishment system has been imposing over the course of 23 years across 28 to 34 states, depending upon which stage of the process we were looking at. And what we found out was that in the three-stage inspections, and this is state judges, federal judges, trial judges, appellate judges, everybody who was looking at these death sentences was finding incredible amounts of error. When you add it up, it turns out that upon full inspection, over two-thirds, almost 7 out of 10 of every death sentence imposed in this country over that almost quarter-century period was found to be seriously flawed in a way that undermined the reliability or trustworthiness of that death sentence and had to be done over again.
Well, Professor Liebman, there are several ways you could look at this. You could say on the one hand, well, the system is working. That's what the appeals process is supposed to do, and so therefore the errors that are made are being caught. Or you could look at it and say, what a horror. What kind of a system do we have where so many mistakes are made in the most important of cases, obviously in capital cases?
Well, I agree that those are the two interpretations one can place on it, but I want to put this in a little bit of perspective. Think of this as an airline instead of a death penalty system that we're flying here. And think of if you had, you know, the airline inspecting its equipment before it took off from the runway, and if they had to take 40% of their airplanes off the tarmac in the first inspection, and then 10% of the remaining, and then 40% of the still remaining planes, leaving only 32 of their original 100 planes to fly, you might say, you know, well, gee, we caught all of those errors. But I think anybody in their right mind would say, that's not an airline that I want to use. And the people on the 32 planes that have supposedly been cleared to fly, when they know how many errors have been found in all the other planes, including 40% at the last inspection, I think would say the last place in the world they want to be is on the 32 planes that are supposedly cleared to fly. Yet that's the kind of death penalty system we're flying right now. And we know that some of the cases that get through the system and are cleared of error actually turn out to be cases of people who are literally innocent of the capital crime, but the system of detecting that error is so overwhelmed by all of the error that it can't catch them all. So Anthony Porter in Illinois, everybody, all of the courts that looked at his case said overwhelming evidence of guilt. Turns out he didn't commit the crime. Somebody else confessed to it.
Professor James Liebman, again, had conducted the study on capital punishment called A Broken System, Error Rates in Capital Cases. I saw Senator Orrin Hatch responding to your report last night, and he said, oh, these are all old cases.
Well, what we have here is almost 25 years worth of cases. This system has been stable for decades. Our data goes up to 1995. We have looked at the trends that were happening up to and after 1995, and what we see is because of the Anti-Terrorism Act passed by Congress in 1996, the federal courts are probably doing somewhat less error detection, but it looks like the state courts are actually picking up some of the slack, and so the error rate may have come down because of less error detection from 68% to maybe 60%. But 60% error, is that something we're confident of, we're happy about, even after we've tried to hamper and handcuff some of the inspectors so they can't catch error as well? I don't think that, you know, that modest change ought to change our view of the implications of all of this error in the system.
Professor Liebman, the issue of prosecutorial misconduct in a lot of these, in some of these cases, I, as a journalist, have covered numerous criminal cases, not that many capital cases, but I have been astounded at times by the amount of desire to win on the part of prosecutors, irrespective of whether they are fulfilling the requirements of justice. Can you talk a little bit about what you uncovered in that area?
Well, what we find is that there is tremendous pressure when a case is identified as a capital case to make that capital charge stick. If a prosecutor charges capitally and doesn't get the capital sentence and, of course, the conviction, that's perceived as a loss. It's a blot on their record, on their reputation. And the community feels like it's not protected because it's been declared a capital case. And so the prosecutor, you know, has a lot of incentive to win the case. Our adversarial system says, well, that's okay. The prosecutor tries to win. You get a good defense lawyer. The defense lawyer tries to win. You put them together, and the truth will come out. The real problem is that the opposition to the prosecutor is so weak because the defense lawyers are paid so little and are, for that reason, not qualified lawyers. By and large, they're very young. They're people on drugs, people on alcohol, people with disciplinary records who can't get any other work, so they're willing to work for the very small wages that you get in these cases. So you've got one a very determined opponent on one side who might cut a few corners here and there in order to get the outcome that he or she wants, and nobody on the other side to catch them, and that mixture is a very, very dangerous mixture of real strong desire to get somewhere that maybe is not where we should be going, and no one on the other side of the case to try and hold that back in any real way.
Professor Liebman, I'm wondering, as an academic, if you're feeling the movement on the ground of this abolitionist cause to end the death penalty, and if that sparked your interest in the death penalty.
I want to put it this way. I've been working on these things, on this study, since the early 1990s, and so this has been an academic labor that we've been at for a long time. And, you know, it came to fruition when we finally got enough time and resources to put it together. It was an accident that we did it. But, you know, I think that what's happening on the ground is quite astonishing to an academic. Nobody predicted this. But I'm not sure I would characterize it exactly as entirely an abolitionist movement, because I think what's happening out there is a much broader movement. You know, most people in this country still support the death penalty. But I think the average citizens, many of whom probably support the death penalty in the abstract, are saying to themselves, you know, this is a government operation. And governments sometimes don't do things very well. And that includes, it turns out, local as well as federal government. And it also turns out to include law enforcement government officials as well as, you know, other kinds of officials that we're used to complaining about. And I think what's really happening is just the coalescing of a lot of opinion across a wide spectrum of political views, but mainly, you know, across the middle, saying, you know, we ought to take a look at this system that's doing something very important, risking lives, supposedly protecting lives, something very important, and we're just not sure anymore that it's functioning in a very accurate way.
In terms of the reaction to your report, since it became public a couple of days ago, what has surprised you in terms of the people who have reacted?
Well, you know, what surprised me the most is just the interest in the study. I mean, when you toil in the academic fields, you sometimes are used to, you know, having 10 or 12 readers of your work. And the interest on the part of the media and on the part of the public, I came back to my office yesterday and had 200 emails, most of them from people I've never met who got my email, you know, from Columbia and just sent me comments. And I think that that really is a reflection of what I said a minute ago. This is an issue that is no longer under the control of either academics or judges or really politicians and policymakers. It's being taken over by the public. It's quite astonishing.
If people want to get a hold of your report, Professor Liebman, where can they call or go on the web?
Well, we tried to get it on the Columbia website, but it took too long there. So an organization called the Justice Project offered, out of the goodness of their heart, to put it up on their website. So that's www.thejusticeproject.org.
That's thejusticeproject.org. Professor James Liebman of Columbia Law School conducted the study on capital punishment called A Broken System, Error Rates in Capital Cases. We're going to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, we go down to Texas to examine the case of Gary Graham, who has a date to die. It's June 22nd, and there is mounting outcry about that case. Then we're going to speak with a Chicago Tribune reporter. He and a team from the Chicago Tribune have looked at all of the cases, all of the executions under George Bush in Texas, and some remarkable findings. Then, if we have time, we're going to hear of a woman, from a woman who was raped, identified her rapist, and he went to jail for 11 years. It turned out she was wrong, and now she's speaking out. You're listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, The Exception to the Rulers. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we now turn to the case of Gary Graham. He's scheduled to die by lethal injection in Texas on June 22nd. He was convicted and sentenced to death for the 1981 fatal shooting of Bobby Lambert. He was 53 years old. It was an attempted nighttime robbery in the parking lot of a Safeway supermarket. Graham's conviction turned on a single eyewitness who allegedly saw him only fleetingly and at night. For 19 years, Gary Graham, known also as Shaka Sankofa, has maintained his innocence. His lawyers have been pressing for a new trial, and they're portraying it as a textbook example of how bad lawyering sends poor people to death row in Texas and in other states across the country. This weekend, on Sunday, in the New York Times, there was a piece by Ray Bonner and Sarah Reimer, which focused on Graham's original lawyer, Ronald Mock. The piece said, Mr. Mock, who boasted in an interview this week that he'd flunked criminal law at Texas Southern University's Thurgood Marshall School of Law, called no witnesses during the guilt phase of Mr. Graham's trial, which lasted 2 days. He did not challenge before the jury the testimony of the single eyewitness who sealed Graham's guilty verdict, although there were other witnesses who could have provided conflicting testimony. He called only two witnesses during the penalty phase when his job was to persuade the jury to spare his client's life. Well, Mock, who had only 3 years of legal experience when he took on Graham's defense, acknowledged in the interview he did almost no investigation of the case. He said he knew in his gut that none of the witnesses could help his client. Mock's investigator, Mervyn West, as well as his co-counsel, Chester Thornton, both say Mock had made it clear that he assumed Graham was guilty. We turn now to our two guests, Richard Burr and Chester Thornton, the original co-counsel on the Gary Graham case. Richard Burr is the current attorney for Gary Graham. Again, his name he has changed to Shaka Sankofa. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Mr. Burr, could you lay out some of the what you consider to be the essential reasons why Graham you believe to be innocent of this case?
Yes. It all comes from the evidence that Mr. Mock failed to have investigated. There were six other eyewitnesses living still by the time we got into the case in 1993. We interviewed them all. Interviewing witnesses is elemental to any criminal defense work. And lo and behold, all of those witnesses excluded Gary Graham as the shooter. They did it in a variety of ways. The two people who had the best opportunity to see the shooter, they saw this young man right up by the front of the store in a well-lighted area for a number of minutes prior to the shooting. The person who had the best opportunity was a cashier. She watched this young man, and he watched her for 15 or 20 minutes. Both of them would have excluded Gary Graham absolutely. They are absolutely certain that the man they saw was 6 inches shorter than Gary Graham, had an entirely different shaped face, much thinner, probably weighed 30 pounds less than Gary Graham, and was dressed in well-tailored clothes. Gary Graham has never had a well-tailored piece of clothing in his life. They didn't testify. They were not interviewed. They were in the police report that Mr. Mock had access to. There were four other witnesses who didn't get as good a view of the shooter's face, but all of them said this man was less than 5 feet 6 inches tall, because they knew he was shorter than the victim, who was 5 feet 6. Gary Graham was nearly 5 feet 10. None of those witnesses were heard. The other thing that was not done, which would undermine, even if you thought Bernadine Skillern might be right, you wouldn't know it if you had heard this. The way in which she identified Gary was this. She and all the other eyewitnesses described the shooter as a person with short afro haircut and no facial hair. Bernadine Skillern saw 10 photos in two different photo arrays. The first one did not have Gary in it, and everybody had long hair and beards. The second one everybody had long hair and or beards. There were some who had shorter hair but facial hair. The only person who had no facial hair and a short haircut was Gary Graham. The only photo that was altered was Gary Graham's. The date of his arrest was blocked out in the photo. It was tantamount to putting a circle around his picture. And sure enough, when she saw that picture, Bernadine Skillern said, "That looks like the guy." And then she said critically to the police officer, "But the man I saw had a thinner face and a darker complexion." And then the police report says she couldn't identify the person from the photo.
Well, if I can just interrupt for 1 second, I'd like to bring in Chester Thornton, who was the former co-counsel to Ronald Mock on the defense on this case. Mr. Thornton, how do you, 20 years later now, how do you react to this issue? Why? How did it happen that none of these witnesses were brought by your defense team to the case?
Mr. Thornton, are you there? We'll get him on in just 1 second. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we look at the case of Gary Graham, and right now, as Richard Burr was just laying out the case of Shaka Sankofa today, whose date to die is the June 22nd, we're going to listen to, for a moment, and this comes from a documentary, Justice on Trial, The Case of Gary Graham. We're going to listen to one of the eyewitnesses. His name was Ron Hubbard, and he was not called to testify.
Someone should have came and asked questions if they knew that I had been a part of this incident and my name was in the records as one of the witnesses. Someone should have spoke to me, and especially on Gary's behalf, because they was defending him.
That was Ron Hubbard, one of the eyewitnesses.
I think we have Chester Thornton on now, the former co-counsel in defense for Gary Graham. Are you there, Mr. Thornton?
Yes, I am.
Well, I'd like to repeat the question I asked before we had the problem. How do you explain that all of these witnesses who might have been able to help the Graham defense were never called by your team?
Well, it's an explanation that goes just beyond. I mean, it's not very a simple explanation. There's involved investigation on cases and whether or not investigate went out and actually performed the work that he was assigned to do. It's a question of whether or not those people were ever contacted, and whether or not once they were contacted, was that information given over to the defense team, and whether or not we acted upon it. That's the question that's in the Gary Graham case.
For example, this person we just listened to, the eyewitness Ron Hubbard, why wasn't he called to the stand? He would have raised questions about the eyewitness testimony that it was Gary Graham.
Well, I'm not exactly sure about why Ron was not called. I believe that Ron was not able to give a for sure identification of Gary Graham. And if that information was accurate, and I'm trying to relate back to 19 years, and I don't have the transcript in front of me, but I think the fact that Ron was not able to identify Gary Graham was brought up through the police officers who testified on the stand to the fact that, sir, there were eyewitnesses. There were also eyewitnesses at the scene. Is that correct? And the police officer would acknowledge that. And, in fact, those eyewitnesses were not able to identify Gary Graham. Now, if that was the tone or the means in which to give that testimony out, that certainly would have brought in the fact that Ron was not able to give a definitive identification of Gary Graham.
Let's go to Ron Hubbard one more time, the eyewitness who says he saw the killer.
Well, during the lineup, they brought in several men, and the policeman asked me, did I recognize any of them as the suspect? And I waited and I watched and I looked, and I could not identify the suspect. I still believe to this day he is not the killer. He is not the one who killed Mr. Lambert.
And now let's go for a minute to a juror who did not hear this conflicting eyewitness testimony. He is Dennis Graham.
He didn't speak, you know, in his behalf. His lawyers did very little, I think, and the way the state did it, the witnesses, the main witness and the other victims presented themselves, we had no choice of finding guilty. As far as the Gary Graham's lawyers presenting the case, he spoke on, basically what he did was just repeat almost what the state prosecutor said, you know. I was sitting in that courtroom and he was defending me, I would have to ask for a different lawyer or something. If it was a different bullet than what he was using, yeah, and they didn't present that in the trial as evidence, that would upset me very much. And if it was a controversial between the witness and this star witness and this other witness, and I mean, a big, you know, 50-50 thing there, it would have been totally different on the decision-making, I know on my part.
Mr. Thornton, I'd like to ask you...
Again, that was the juror, Dennis Graham, who did not hear this other testimony.
We understand that you were not the lead counsel, that Ronald Mock was, and that Mr. Mock has, I guess, a dubious reputation as being a defense attorney that has unsuccessfully defended more capital cases, perhaps, than anyone else in Texas. Can you explain to us whether you feel now, looking back on it, that you and Mr. Mock presented competent defense of his case, of Gary Graham's case?
Well, as part of the defense team, it's no way that I'm going to try to separate myself from the defense team. I was a part of the defense team back then. I pled with a jury back then to save Gary's life. The jury who just spoke, regardless of whether or not he felt that the testimony was not presented right, and if it was presented differently, he might have reached a different conclusion as far as Gary being sentenced to death. The fact remains that I pled with that same jury and pled with all those juries at the punishment hearing that if you, in fact, believe that Gary committed this crime, there still was mitigating factors, and there were many factors that should have been taken into consideration by that same jury as far as them reaching a sentence of death. If, in fact, Ron Hubbard or any of the witnesses to the actual shooting, their testimony was either convincing or not convincing to the jury, the fact that remains that the jury still had a determination of whether or not, regardless of everything that Gary Graham did he deserve to die? And I requested, and I pleaded with a jury back then, just like I plead for his life now, that Gary should not have been sentenced to death. So it's very hard for me to go back and say, well, 19 years ago, we should have done this differently. And obviously, any lawyer who has practiced the criminal defense law or any type of law, we always want to go back and have done things differently. Now, I'm a part of the defense team. I was sitting second chair. That doesn't resolve me any responsibility in the Gary Graham case. Would I have handled it differently? I certainly would have. Would I have handled the trial differently? I certainly would have. But at the same time, those jurors made a decision that Gary should die, and that didn't have anything to do with whether or not they believe the testimony of the eyewitnesses. The ultimate answer was a 19-year-old young black man who committed a number of offenses, did he deserve to die? And that jury determined that he did.
Did Mock think he was guilty?
He has expressed that to me. I mean, other people, not just myself, but
his defense attorney.
He has expressed that more than one time that he felt that Gary was guilty. I didn't know whether or not Gary was guilty of the murder or not. To this day, I'm not sure whether he was or not. And that's the position most defense lawyers have to take.
Well, it seems to me that, Richard Burr, you're convinced not only that he shouldn't have been sentenced to death, but that he wasn't even guilty of this particular crime. Although no one is claiming that Gary Graham was an angel, and obviously he himself has admitted to participating in numerous robberies right after this particular crime that he's accused of, and of shooting two people. So, but was he guilty of this particular crime?
All the evidence that I know of says he was not. I mean, I'm very sympathetic to Chester Thornton. He is in a difficult position. But in fact, the truth is Chester Thornton was focused on penalty work and Ron Mock was focused on guilt innocence work. Ron Mock never talked to any of these eyewitnesses, nor did Chester, for that matter, nor did the investigator. All of the eyewitnesses will tell you that. They didn't hear from anybody on the defense team. In fact, the best work that was done in the trial was done by Chester Thornton in a suppression hearing to suppress the identification of Gary Graham away from the jury. The jury didn't hear this. And in fact, Chester did bring out from a police officer that Ron Hubbard saw the same live lineup that Skillern saw and did not identify Gary Graham. That was a good thing, but then that did not get brought out to the jury, unfortunately, because Ron Mock did the examinations of witnesses before the jury.
So tell us the situation we're in right now, Richard Burr. June 22nd is the execution date for Gary Graham. I'm sure a lot of people are saying, well, why is all this coming out right now, and what is the legal process you have to go through?
This information has been out since 1993, Amy. We have been trying desperately through two complete rounds of state and federal habeas corpus proceedings to get one court somewhere in the state or federal system to hold a hearing, to hear these witnesses, to hear Bernadine Skillern, and to make a judgment about whether Gary had a fair trial. Not one judge has heard one of these eyewitnesses. Not one. And that's what is so frustrating right now. We are on the brink of execution. This is not, you know, newly discovered, sort of last-minute evidence. We've had it out there 7 years, and nobody has listened to it. That's not how this system is supposed to work. You know, anything any system that approaches the goal of fairness will listen to witnesses and allow the examination of witnesses in front of an impartial judge. That hasn't happened. We are out of court. We have no legal remedies left. We are pleading with the governor and the Pardon and Parole Board in Texas to grant clemency. They have the power to grant what's called a conditional pardon, which is a pardon that is, it erases the conviction, conditioned on Gary Graham waiving his double jeopardy rights and submitting to a new trial. That's what needs to be done. This young man needs a new trial. He doesn't need a life sentence for a crime he didn't commit. He doesn't need to be put to death for a crime he didn't commit. He needs a new trial. And that's what the governor and the Pardon and Parole Board need to be called upon, raised up to do.
If people are concerned about this case, do calls make a difference?
Like calls, faxes, emails.
The phone number for Governor George Bush in Austin, Texas, it's interesting. It certainly does make a difference, we know, when people call, because when we people the interview with Leonard Peltier over the last few days and gave out numbers to the Justice Department, within hours they had disconnected the number. But as long as this number lasts, this number of Governor George Bush, it's 512-463-2000. That is 512-463-2000. And the fax number is 512-463-1849. That's 512-463-1849. I want to thank you both for being with us. Chester Thornton, original co-counsel for Gary Graham in his trial, and Richard Burr, attorney for Shaka Sankofa, formerly Gary Graham, today. When we come back, we're going to look at the executions under George Bush. George Bush, who has made this claim.
If you're asking me whether or not I feel like that everybody who's been executed is guilty of the crime to which they've been convicted of, the answer is yeah, I believe that.
That is Governor George Bush. We'll go to a Chicago Tribune reporter that has looked at the more than 130 executions Governor Bush has presided over, and also hear from a rape victim about the eyewitness testimony she gave, which ultimately was wrong. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. George W. Bush has been under increasing scrutiny as the governor who's presided over more executions than any governor in U.S. history, more than 130. While many are raising questions, Bush himself is quite confident.
If you're asking me whether or not I feel like that everybody who's been executed is guilty of the crime to which they have, to which they have been that they've been convicted of, the answer is yeah, I believe that.
We pulled that from Michael Moore's TV show. It airs on Wednesday nights on the Bravo network. It's called The Awful Truth. And a team of Chicago Tribune reporters are saying there is an awful truth after doing the first study of all the cases of the men and women Bush has executed. The reporters have found that many of the cases were compromised, shaped by witnesses, experts, and lawyers of questionable merit. They include a forensic scientist who was temporarily released from a psychiatric ward to provide incriminating testimony in a capital case, a pathologist who has admitted faking autopsies, a psychiatrist nicknamed Dr. Death, who was expelled from the American Psychiatric Association, a judge on the state's highest criminal court who's been reprimanded for lying about his background, and a defense attorney infamous for sleeping during trials. Ken Armstrong joins us now, who's the legal affairs writer for the Chicago Tribune, co-author of the Tribune's two-part series on the death penalty in Texas under Bush. You've just listened to the lawyers talking about Gary Graham's case, slated to die on June 22nd. You went back and looked at all the executions under Bush. What were the most egregious in your impression?
Well, there were several, but one thing that stands out is you've just heard Dick Burr describe the role that Ron Mock played in the Gary Graham case and how the fact that he did little or no work to prepare for trial, to investigate for evidence of innocence, to challenge the state's case. What we found is that the Graham case and the role that the poor defense in that case played is no aberration. It is not an isolated case. We found that in fully a third of the cases where a defendant has been executed under Governor Bush, the defendant was represented either at trial or on direct appeal by an attorney who has been sanctioned for misconduct at some point in his career. Ron Mock is one of those attorneys. He's been disciplined at least five times during his career. Capital cases are perhaps the most demanding that any criminal defense lawyer can tackle. You know, you almost want to see a sign above the courtroom door saying only the best need apply. In this body of Texas cases, these defendants and the court system have not received the best, very far from it.
One of the things that amazed me in your articles was that there was a psychiatrist who testified in 29 different trials that the defendant, based on his previous record, would be a threat to commit future violence, but the psychiatrist never actually met or interviewed any of the people that he was testifying about.
Yes, it's a brand of testimony that is used commonly in Texas capital cases. It involves a psychiatrist who will offer a prediction about a defendant's propensity for future violence. That's a crucial issue in Texas capital cases for that the jury has to decide when determining whether or not a defendant should live or die. Often these psychiatrists, and Dr. James Grigson is perhaps the best known practitioner of this, will tell the jury that a defendant will commit violence in the future. He will kill again or commit some other form of violence, and they will offer this prediction without having examined the defendant. It will be based upon a question that purports to lay out the defendant's criminal background, criminal history. And one of the most disturbing things about this testimony, at least the American Psychiatric Association, is that it's all often offered with absolute certainty. Dr. Grigson would often tell juries that the defendant absolutely would commit violence again. He would even assign percentages to it, that it's not 99.5% sure, it's 99 point whatever. He gave them what in effect was an ironclad guarantee that a defendant would commit violence in the future. The American Psychiatric Association has consistently condemned this type of testimony as both unethical and untrustworthy. They had reprimanded Dr. Grigson for continuously testifying in this manner, and when he didn't stop, they ultimately expelled him.
We're talking to Ken Armstrong, and he is co-author of a two-part series in the Chicago Tribune that looks at George Bush's death penalty. He was also a writer for the Tribune series Failure of the Death Penalty in Illinois, which helped to lead to the governor of Illinois, George Ryan, concluding that at this point the death penalty could no longer be imposed in Illinois.
Your article also talked that there were 40 cases where the defense attorneys presented no evidence or only one witness during the sentencing phase. Could you talk a little bit about that and how critical the sentencing phase is in these capital cases?
Sure. Capital cases in Texas, as they are in most states, are bifurcated. You have a phase where guilt or innocence is determined, and then if the defendant is found guilty and eligible or the death penalty, you then proceed to a second phase where evidence is presented from both sides as to whether or not the defendant should live or die. You know, the prosecution will offer evidence indicating that he has a violent history, that he does not have redeeming qualities, and the defense, on the other hand, will often bring in a long line of witnesses, you know, who will argue for the defendant's life, who will offer testimony about different factors that might be potential grounds for mercy. For example, if a defendant suffered an abusive childhood or has a low IQ, perhaps brain damage or mental retardation, if he has certain things in his background which help put the particular crime in context, that type of testimony is to be presented at the sentencing stage so that the jury can put everything into context. What we found in these Texas cases is that the defense at this stage often, in effect, performed a laydown. They presented no testimony or evidence whatsoever, or they might have presented only one. Those 40 don't include the Gary Graham case, because in that case they presented two witnesses at sentencing. So the cases that are beyond that 40 by no means are ones that were necessarily tried vigorously. That was simply the cutoff that we used for that particular statistic. What's troubling here is that a number of defendants who had been executed under Governor Bush had much in their background which could have been considered as grounds for mercy, but the jury never learned of it. Terry Washington is a good example. Mr. Washington was born with fetal alcohol syndrome. He was brain damaged. He could not count or tell time. He was described as having the mental capacity of a 7-year-old. The jury never learned any of those things when they sentenced him to death.
I'm curious, how many of these 131, is it now, cases, were the defendants represented by court-appointed attorneys, and how many actually had their own attorneys?
The great majority had court-appointed counsel. That would be typical in almost any state that you would find. Most people who face murder charges, particularly capital murder charges, don't have the resources to hire their own attorneys. What is perhaps noteworthy in Texas is that only 3 of the counties in Texas have a public defender's office. So the attorneys, when they are appointed, are invariably appointed by locally elected district court judges. And legislators in Texas have been concerned for quite a while that these district court judges have a propensity to appoint friends, cronies, campaign contributors, and defense attorneys who are more concerned with trying a case quickly rather than vigorously. The idea is that a district court judge who has an overcrowded docket has some interest in seeing a case tried quickly. It doesn't necessarily ensure that the case will be tried well, but it does mean it will be off the judge's docket quickly.
Well, we know the death penalty is going to be a major issue at the Republican convention, perhaps not inside the convention, but outside. There are expected to be thousands of protesters, and after all, it is going to be in Pennsylvania. And that is where Mumia Abu-Jamal is on death row, and one of the people's names that's being thrown around as vice president is Governor Tom Ridge, who has signed a death warrant twice for Mumia Abu-Jamal. If people want to get a hold of the series you did on George Bush's death row, where can they go on the web, Ken Armstrong?
It would be at chicagotribune.com.
We want to thank you for the series, and we'll be back to you at different points on your investigation, a very important one. But we're going to end today's program with a woman who is a rape victim. Yesterday, there was a big news conference in Houston, Texas. All sorts of people came out to call for Gary Graham not to be executed. Among them was actor Danny Glover and others. Jennifer Thompson was also there. She misidentified her rapist, sending an innocent man to prison for 11 years. She spoke in support of Gary Graham at yesterday's news conference. This is what she had to say.
In 1984, I was a 22-year-old college student, 4.0 GPA, and I really wanted to do something with my life. One night, someone broke into my apartment, put a knife to my throat, and he raped me. During the ordeal, I studied every single detail on his face. I made sure that I looked at his hairline, scars, for any tattoos, for any jewelry, for anything that would help me to identify this man, because I was confident that when and if I got out, should I be allowed to see the next day, that I was going to make sure he was put in prison and he was going to rot. I went down to the police station. I did a composite drawing. To the best of my ability, I looked through hundreds of noses and eyes and eyebrows and hairlines and nostrils and lips, and I put together a composite drawing. Several days later, I did a photo lineup, and I identified my attacker, and I knew who he was. I was confident. I was so sure. Several days later, I did a physical lineup, and I picked him out. Same man, photo lineup. I picked him out, and it was him. I knew it. I had picked the right guy, and he was going to go to jail, and he was going to rot there. And if there was a death penalty, I wanted him to die, and I would be there to pull the plug. In 1986, we went to court, and I stood on the witness stand and I put my hand on the Bible and I swore that I would tell the truth, and I did. And Ronald Cotton was sentenced to prison for life, and it was the happiest day of my life because I could put it behind me. And in 1987, we had to retry it. The appellate court overturned the verdict and we retried the case. And under voir dire, they brought in another gentleman who had supposedly claimed to have been my attacker and was bragging about it in the same prison wing that Ronald Cotton was serving time for the rest of his life. And they brought Bobby Poole in front of me and they said, "Miss Thompson, have you ever seen this man?" And I said, "I've never seen him in my life. I have no idea who he is." Ronald Cotton was sentenced again for two life sentences. Ronald Cotton was never going to see light. He was never going to get out. He was never going to hurt another woman. He was never going to rape another woman. And he served until 1995 when DNA became available, and I was asked to take a blood test. Would I submit to it? And I said, sure, because I knew that Ronald Cotton had raped me, and DNA was only going to prove that, and then we could really put it behind me. I could move on. I was a mom now. I was married, and I was very happy. DNA test came back, and I'll never forget the day I was standing in my kitchen, and the detective and the district attorney, who are good and decent people, who are trying to do their job, and I had done mine, just like any of you would. You were doing the right thing. Came back and told me, "Ronald Cotton didn't rape you. It was Bobby Poole. The man I had never seen before in my life. The man who was inches from my face with a knife to my throat, who raped me, who hurt me, who took my spirit away, who robbed me of my soul." Ronald Cotton was released after 11 years. He and I are the same age. See, I knew what had happened during those 11 years. I had gone on. I had been married. I graduated. I worked. I was a mommy. Ronald Cotton didn't get to do that. Ronald Cotton would have been dead if he had been sentenced in the state of Texas. Ronald Cotton is married now, and he's a daddy. Ronald's my friend. I'm here to tell you that eyewitnesses can make mistakes. And I am sorry. And I'm sorry that these people behind me had to serve time and could have been killed. And I ask you and I beg you, I beseech you. There are sons and daughters, and there are moms and dads, and there are husbands and wives that are out there. And you can't do this to Gary Graham. Because if there's any doubt, if there's this much doubt in any of your hearts and in any of your souls, if you think there's this much doubt that Gary Graham didn't do this, and I believe that he didn't, can any one of you stand there and say, I can pull that plug. I can pull that plug tonight, and I can eat my dinner, and I can go to bed, and I can wake up tomorrow, and I can justify it. Because a life for a life. Because if there's any doubt, you can't do it. Gary Graham has 10 days left on this planet. 10 days. You guys have the rest of your lives. Can you take it away from him? I don't think you can. And I ask you, the good people of Texas and Governor Bush, to really view this evidence. Think about it. It's wrong. These people behind me would be dead because one person said they saw them. And those people were wrong, and I was wrong. Thank you.
Jennifer Thompson speaking on Monday on behalf of Gary Graham in Houston, Texas, standing in front of a group of people who had been exonerated and taken off of death row, who had been falsely accused.
If you're asking me whether or not I feel like that everybody who's been executed is guilty of the crime to which they have been convicted of, the answer is yeah, I believe that.
I still believe to this day he is not the killer. He is not the one who killed Mr. Lambert.
And if you want more information on the case, you can go to our website at www.pacifica.org or democracynow.org. You can also call Governor Bush in Austin at 512-463-2000. The number to call is 512-463-2000. Gary Graham is slated to die on June 22nd. That does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. We did call the district attorney's office in Texas to ask for them to participate in the show, and they didn't return our calls. Democracy Now! Is produced by David Love and Jeremy Scahill. Errol Maitland's our technical director. Anthony Sloan engineered today's show with help from Matthew Finch. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!